Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Jane Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 56 through 61, the last six chapters of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
We made it! Yay! Pop the champagne.
Two books down.
Oh, I'm like super impressed with us. This is like a milestone.
We've been doing this for a while. I mean, I know like real life and, you know, pandemic things have made things a little harder to be so consistent, but we did it. We're still here. We made it.
Yeah. No, this has been really, really great. I'm sad this book is over. But I'm excited to finish up with you and read some more books. So this is good.
It is. I can finally shed my like scarlet letter of not having actually read this book before. So, and it was super worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I our outline's like 20 pages long because I like wrote down pretty much every quote. So I apologize in advance.
It was a real problem because it turns out like on Kindle, on my desktop, some books have a limit on how many times you can copy and paste something. And
what?
I hit that limit like halfway through the book. So I've been typing everything out. And there was a lot to type out in these chapters.
I had no idea there was a limit.
I don't know if it's just the edition I got, something with the publisher. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it kind of is like a nice, almost, I don't want to say meditative, but very like mindful practice almost to like go back and look at the words and actually type them out and feel them coming from my brain to my fingers. But at the same time, it was very tiring. And the cat just kept sitting on my hands going, this is where I sit, right? This helps you. Oh, hi, cat.
She is helpful. So she's your assistant. I mean,
she is. And she, for such little pay, she's very involved.
She's very cute, so it's fine. If you want to plug your cat's Instagram, I will let you do that.
Yes, Kala the Kit, K-A-L-A-T-H-E-K-I-T. I should probably know this.
Way to go.
I can spell. But yeah, before we get into that and all things good and Austen, why don't you tell me what you've been catching up with?
Yes. So following my string of very good books, I was lucky to get to read just before this episode. Did I hear a purr? Is that her?
You did, because she really got up in there.
Yes. I read Cemetery Boys by Aidan Thomas. So it's a paranormal young adult book about a trans boy named Yadriel who is determined to prove his gender to his traditional Latinx family. And also he summons the ghost of a school bad boy named Julian Diaz who refuses to leave. And so Yadriel basically agrees to help Julian with some unfinished ghost business in time for Dia de Muertos. He has an awesome cousin named Maritza who helps him. And as he tries to help Julian tie up all his loose ends, him and Julian get close. And honestly, everyone should read this. It's delightful, scary, heartwarming, lovely, perfect for the month of October. And I explained it very weird, but basically...
No, honestly, I didn't know all that happened in the book. So now I want to read it.
And this is just like, I'm not spoiling anything. Like, this is the back cover description of the book. But it's really cool. It's dissects issues of gender and family and relationships. And it's spooky and cool and lovely. And I really, really recommend this to everybody. It's a young adult book. But as most young adult books are, I recommend it to everybody. Definitely read it and then come talk about it with me, particularly you, Annie.
Oh, okay. Because I need more books.
But come on, this one, ghosts, boys, and love, it's so good.
I can't think of any other way I'd want to spend October. I think it's also still Hispanic Heritage Month, too.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Yeah, it made me, like, really, like, they describe all the Dia de Muertos food, and it made me really want all of it. The detail is very good. You're going to be very hungry while reading this book.
I mean, that's my normal state anyway.
And then we both read at the same time Solutions and Other Problems by Ali Brosh. And I think it might be the funniest and most profound book I've ever read in my life. Ali Brosh, you've probably seen her memes around the internet. She drew those, how do you describe them? Like sort of stick figure-like drawings of a like, pink dress, blonde hair.
Yeah, with the ponytail-esque thing. It's, in many ways, seems very rudimentary, but weirdly very expressive.
Yes, and very, and she's gotten better at drawing, too.
Yeah, the detail has really, the detail has gotten, like, incredibly good, which I guess happens over 10 years.
From her original blog was called Hyperbole and a Half, and that was what her first book was called. And I think it was published, like, 2013-ish?
7 years ago? Yeah.
Yeah, and she wrote this really profound cartoon that's funny and sad about depression. I think that one circulates a lot, too. And then she sort of disappeared off the internet for 7 years, and no one heard from her, and everyone was pretty worried about her. She used to be really on Reddit a lot. And then she came out with this book sort of all of a sudden called Solutions and Other Problems. And in between the publishing of the first book and this book, her parents got divorced or separated. She got divorced. Her sister passed away, and just so much happened. And she wrote this book, and it's just incredible. It's just as good as her last book. And yeah, I don't even know how to describe it because the vignettes are so different, but it's so funny.
So funny. It's, I mean, it's just like life. There are times that are just like really sad, or you're faced with the opening and yawning void of emptiness inside you, or you're facing mortality, or you're, you know, you have a dog that is terminally ill and you're mourning this thing for a year before they finally die. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's absurd and it's silly and it's hysterical and it's just weird and confusing. No, she does a really great job of mixing all the complex emotions, just experiencing life, into very simple things. And some of it is just idle thoughts. Some of it is also just existential crisis after existential crisis, which, as you explained, so many things happened to her in so short a time, one might be expected to go through such things. And she does just an amazing job of expressing it and making you feel a part of it and relating to it. And at the same time, you're laughing at it and you feel kind of like a terrible human being at the same time because of it.
Yeah, I texted Annie once. I was like, I'm laughing at this story about her sister dying, and I feel really weird about it, but I think I'm meant to laugh about it. So,
yeah.
If that doesn't excite you, I don't know what will.
I know. Probably my favorite moments that stuck with me the most is like all of a sudden you're seeing like these lashes through what seem to be really abstract memories of her sister and her like as kids, and somehow they're still so emotional and so full of meaning, and you know exactly what's happening in them, and your heart just swells. And then the next thing you know, she's talking about this terminally ill dog who's wearing a sweater that can't even cover his whole body. And it's the dumbest, funniest thing I have ever seen in a book, and it's killing me now even.
Yeah, so it's very good. Both Annie and I recommend.
Easy to reread too.
Yes, I. This is definitely one I'm glad to have on my bookshelf, as opposed to just, yeah, don't read the audiobook of this. I don't think it would transfer.
No, full color pages,
yeah.
Highly recommend.
Anyway, that's my favorite stuff that I've read and consumed since. How about you, Annie? What's up with you?
Other than falling once again in love with Ally Brush. Finally finished Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. Just about as beautiful a book as I could imagine. Kind of striking in how very simply everything is said. It's just a lovely book. It's very complicated, but I love how almost matter of fact a lot of it is. Would recommend. The audiobook version is how I read it, and the narrator does a great job. Also an audiobook, I read Alan Cumming's Not My Father's Son. He's written a lot of autobiographical books. This one was about his relationship with his father, who was very abusive in his life, and the period where he thought that he literally was not his father's son, and all that came with. It's funny. It's thoughtful that you get these flashes of his celebrity life and of his childhood growing up and what it was like growing up in such a dramatic environment. So would also recommend. And if you happen to like Scottish accents, Alan Cumming has one. So,
well, you sold me there.
How can you not love Alan Cumming? I mean, really?
Yeah, he's fantastic.
So before we crack on with summaries and everything, I've been sitting on this email since, March, from one of our lovely listeners and friends, Tasia, who rightfully calls us out on our early book attempts to sort of, I guess, relitigate Mrs. Bennet as a character, as someone who is often criticized and put down. And I think early in the book, she's mostly fairly benign, so I think it was okay. But also she does terrible things. So I've been waiting for this because there were so many spoilers in it. Hello, lovelies. So I've been wanting to write this email for a while, but the timing never seemed right. I just didn't want to get too ahead of where you were in the book story, blah, blah, blah. Because I knew you wouldn't be able to read the spoiler bits on the show, but fuck it. You can save it for later or never read it on the show. I just wanted to put this out there. I know you two are trying to be more sympathetic to Mrs. Bennet in this read because it's true. She gets a lot of hate from the readers. And in some cases, you're absolutely right. The hate is unjustified and oftentimes sexist coded. However, I'm here to make a case that she is, in fact, legitimately trash at least 75% of the time, which is a pretty high percentage of trash if you're considering redemption. The last few times I read this book, I tried so hard to sympathize with her, but she just really sucks. I present you my evidence. Number one, she is wildly cavalier about the health and well-being of her children, considering the prospect of marriage is more important than, say, their actual safety. Several times, Jane getting sick because Mrs. Bad Mom made her walk all the way to the Netherfield in a rainstorm and refusing to send a carriage, sending a 15-year-old Lydia off with dubious chaperones to a fucking military encampment filled with the Regency equivalent of bros, etc. Two, refuses to talk Elizabeth for days after she refuses to marry Mr. Condescending dumbshit cousin. Three, when Lydia, predictably, fucks off to be defiled by Wickham and certainly not married, she blames literally everyone but herself, despite the fact she practically begged Mr. Bennet to give Lydia permission to go. Four,
fair,
is consistently straight-up cruel to the daughters that are not Jane and Lydia, and occasionally, as referenced above, criminally neglectful of even them. Five, even after Elizabeth marries the most advantageously of all her daughters, still acts like Lydia made out so much better and Elizabeth sucks? Adores Wickham, despite the fact that he had to be bribed into marrying her daughter. Mr. Bennet is also guilty of this. Six, Lydia also fucking sucks, to be honest. Anyways, I could probably keep going, but it's been a while since I finished my latest read, and this is what I came up with off the top of my head. Your honors, I rest my case. Lydia, yeah. Tasia. I don't know any lawyer terms, so I'm just going to say,
You've made your case, I think, is the correct term I would use here.
Yes, I would say guilty.
And we should sort of plug right here, our friend Tasia and our other friend Corinne just started their own podcast called Act Ya Age, like Act YA Age. And it's a podcast where they talk about young adult books. And go check it out.
They are delightful and hilarious and know what they're talking about.
Clearly.
Actually, they're usually like the big book influencers for us. We are merely but humble followers in many ways.
Yes, they've read Cemetery Boys too. And I'm assuming that they were going to be talking about it on their podcast. So
they're definitely why we ended up reading Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Oh, that's true.
And I think actually How to Lose a Time War.
Oh, man.
Yeah, go listen to them.
Go check them out. And Tasia's email is a good setup there. So
yes. Thank you so much, Tasia, by the way, for writing in a million years ago. We genuinely loved it and love hearing from you. You're the best. So previously on,
Lydia returns to Longbourn with her rogue husband Wickham in tow. The two refuse to admit anything happened, and Lydia forces everyone to go along with the charade. Lydia also lets slip that no other than, gasp, Mr. Darcy attended her wedding. Lizzie employs Mrs. Gardner, who tells her that it was Darcy and not Mr. Gardner who tracked Wickham and Lydia down and settled the entire affair. Finally, the Wickhams leave up north, but not after Lizzie gets in a few parting shots. No sooner have the Wickhams left than Bingley returns to Netherfield. He eventually shows up to Longbourn, Darcy in tow. Darcy makes no signs to indicate that he's there for Lizzie, much to her consternation, but after a few visits, Bingley eventually gets the courage to propose to Jane, who proclaims that she is the happiest creature in the world.
Ah, love, young love.
So we have one of our sisters, or two of our sisters settled, I guess.
Two out of five, that's pretty good odds.
Yeah, Mrs. Bennet should be very happy.
Should be. Yeah. But we'll get to that. And in case anyone did what I did in high school and just didn't read things and listen to the summary, this part's for you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I try. For chapters 56 through 61, the very end, we have a surprise visitor to Longbourn. Why, it's Lady Catherine de Bourgh herself, and she's not exactly nice about it. Turns out she heard not just about Jane's engagement, but word has it, Elizabeth has tricked Darcy into engagement as well. That is not the plan. Lady C explains with all the civility of a Fitzwilliam Darcy proposing why he should be marrying her daughter and why marrying Elizabeth cannot happen. Despite all the insistence that Elizabeth promised never to get engaged to Darcy, Lady Catherine leaves without satisfaction. A few days later, Darcy and Bingley come to visit, too. Bingley and Jane go off to walk, and Darcy and Elizabeth find themselves alone, allowing Lizzie the chance to thank him for what he did for Lydia. Darcy escalates things real fast, asking her if her feelings have changed since the last time he shouted his love at her. Her response to Lady Catherine had given him hope, and he regrets how he acted and proposed the first time around. Not only did Darcy help with Lydia purely out of love for Elizabeth, but he also cleared things up with Bingley, telling him about Jane being in London and recognized the love that she had for him in kind. Bingley, being the precious cinnamon roll he is, and also being too busy being in love with Jane, forgave Darcy. So it's totally cool and clear now. Elizabeth, in turn, apologizes for how she treated Darcy, so now they totes can get married too. Elizabeth tells Jane about the engagement that night, because they are the best friends, and Jane cannot believe it at first. She was supposed to be the easy one to convince, too. The next day, Darcy asks Mr. Bennet for consent to marry Elizabeth, which he gives because he's rich, but he can't believe that Elizabeth... But he can't believe that Elizabeth would marry a man she hates. Eventually, he's convinced as well, and then finds out what Darcy did for Lydia. Now, Mr. Bennet will have a second son-in-law he likes, and then there's, like, Wickham. Mrs. Bennet doesn't take as much convincing. He's so rich and handsome and tall. A lot of letters get exchanged. News of the engagement spreads fast. Lots of people are generally happy, or they learn to live with it, including Miss Bingley and Lady Catherine, who suck it up so they can keep visiting Pemberley. The Wickhams keep asking their rich sisters for money because it turns out they haven't learned their lesson. The Bingleys move closer to the Darcys and further away from Mrs. Bennet because their goodness has an upper limit. Kitty grows up a little, mainly by staying away from Lydia. Georgiana gets a sister. The Gardiners also visit Pemberley often because they are awesome. And Mr. and Mrs. Darcy live happily ever after in love and in laughter.
Aww.
The end!
The end!
Oh.
And that's it. That's the end of the podcast forever.
I know. Let's just walk away now. if this is as far as we get, I think we've done so much and can be real happy about it.
But no, we have a lot to discuss.
Yeah, no, we can't not talk about Lady Catherine, who just barges in and is super rude. Who just shows up at someone's house without invitation and is just like poking through the rooms and talking about how small their garden is?
Oh my god, the line about the garden is iconic. Like, there seems to be a prettyish sort of little wilderness on the side of your lawn. I should be glad to take a turn in it. Like, a prettyish, really?
The most iconic, though, is Mrs. Bennet's response with, like, oh, it's nothing in comparison of Rosings, my lady, I dare say, but I assure you it is much larger than Sir William Lucas's.
I totally missed that. How did I miss that? That's hysterical.
Just, I've been really amused by the constant low-key, completely, not exactly one-sided either, but just constant competition with the Lucases.
Oh, that's so funny. You know, it's really subtle the way that it's written, because I don't think I really grasped all of it until just now, but that's wonderful.
It's so good.
But yes, Lady Catherine is extremely rude, but so she shows up because she has heard a rumor that Jane's about to be married and Elizabeth will be married to Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, like, Jane is one thing, but I'm sorry, Miss Bennet, first of all. Who do you think you are, apparently? She's really, like, accusing that the whole thing, not just the engagement, but, like, the rumor that it's happening is Elizabeth being very ambitious and making this happen. Confront your nephew, young lady.
That's a good
point.
If it's
such a problem.
That she, like, first of all, to make the effort to schlep from Rosings to Longbourn, like, it's pretty far away. I don't remember. Did we see it was, like, 30 miles? I don't know. It was pretty far.
It was far. It's far.
So she makes this trek all the way to have this information be refuted by Elizabeth. And so it has to be a pretty substantial rumor. Like, she wouldn't go all that way if she was just sort of, if it wasn't there wasn't any substance to it. Mm-hmm. But she says, like, I know it must be scandalous falsehood, though I would not injure him so much as to suppose the truth of it possible. I instantly resolved on setting off for this place that I might make my sentiments known to you. So I think it's less that she wants Elizabeth to say no, but that she wants Elizabeth to know that it can't happen for all these reasons, and I'm going to put a stop to it. So there's, like, two reasons that she makes the journey all the way there.
She puts so much of the power in Elizabeth, as if Elizabeth isn't, like, the one of the lower echelon, and Darcy isn't a very stubborn individual himself. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. It's so weird.
And the sass here from Elizabeth is, like, peak sass. It, like, if this were me and Lady Catherine showed up, like, I would be super intimidated. And I'd be like, no, 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 like, we're not engaged. But, like, she says, has my nephew made an offer of marriage? And she goes, your ladyship just declared it to be impossible. Like, she's just being, like, deliberately stubborn and obstinate for, like, just sassy reasons. And it's spectacular. I love it so much. Yeah. Like, the whole exchange is just a masterclass in being awesome.
Just standing up for yourself. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is not necessarily, like, protecting her and Darcy. A lot of it is very similar to what we saw in the beginning when Darcy was one being like, meh, she's not handsome enough. And she's like, oh, hello, fire and brimstone and reaction. Like, this is the kind of thing that the day after someone insults you and you're in the shower going, why did I say this instead? This is all of those, but she's just throwing them out at her.
You can't see, but I'm, like, nodding emphatically because I agree. She's, like, not so much standing up for Darcy. She's standing up for herself because even because like Catherine, like Lady de Burgh is saying, your arts and allurements may in a moment of infatuation have made him forget what he owes to himself. Like, do you know who I am? Like, I'm as the nearest relation that he has. I'm entitled to know his concerns. And Elizabeth doesn't say, like, no, you're not. It's none of your business. Instead, she says, but you're not entitled to know mine. Mm-hmm. I love that she's standing up for herself and not just standing up for Darcy or being defensive. It's really empowering and very kind of cool.
Yeah, she knows her. She understands who she is and her own personal worth, even though, like, even though Darcy in the past has looked down her nose at her, and she's heard from, like, Miss Bingley. And Lady Catherine is certainly the kind of person who just constantly in everything she says in a conversation reminds everyone how wonderful and amazing and higher than everyone she is, and how, oh, in everything she says about someone else is always somehow, like, a backhanded compliment about, wow, you're real good for whatever it is you are. Mm-hmm. And her, like, just weird entitlement and just this expectation that this isn't how it's done. We've got to preserve the bloodlines. This is what it was, like, what the mothers wanted for him. This was the plan. And as if somehow all these explanations are, like, as if somehow Elizabeth has some stake in preserving things as they are, which is baffling to me, just the sheer cluelessness and privilege around all of her, that you should be happy to stay in your position. And at some point, you know, what's she say? She says, you know, in marrying your nephew, I should not consider myself as quitting that sphere, you know, the sort of middle class sphere that she's in. He is a gentleman. I'm a gentleman's daughter. So far, we are equal. And it's like, yes, she knows. Maybe they don't have as much money, but she recognizes that, you know, not just in social, you know, social class and all that stuff, she knows that they're equal in other ways too.
Yeah, that's one of the, I think, a very iconic quote from this book. She's really standing up for herself, and she's it's so good. And Lady Catherine is, like, just insulting her in this, like, you know, Lady Catherine wants something from her. She wants Elizabeth to say, I'm not engaged, I'm never going to be engaged, you know, and bow down to her. And Elizabeth's not giving her any of that. She's not, like, assisting her in this process at all. Like, we know they're not engaged. At this point, Elizabeth thinks they're never going to be engaged. She thinks Darcy hates her and wants nothing to do with her family. And here comes Lady Catherine being like, oh, I know what happened to your sister. I know that that marriage was really shady. I know that if Darcy marries you, he'll have this connection with this horrible, awful man. And Elizabeth, this is nothing Elizabeth doesn't know. This has been going through her mind over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But, like, she still refuses to back down. And she says, like, I am as equal to him. And even your nephew knows all these things. So whatever my connections may be, if your nephew does not object to him, there can be nothing for you there. And then Lady Catherine, like, pulls out this trump card. Did you know that he's engaged to my daughter? And Elizabeth's like, well, if they're engaged, then why even bother coming to me? Mm-hmm. And Lady Catherine has to be like, oh, well, you know, it's a peculiar engagement. You know, they were intended from their cradles, you know, like what his mother wanted them to be engaged. And Liz was like, okay, well, if that's true, then get off my back.
Yeah. The whole time, it's just this very much the sense of this is what's accepted and right, and this is what I want, and you should be grateful and happy to make sure that it happens the way that I want. She fully admits, you know, coming in there being like, you know, this is not how I'm used to being treated. The whole time she's just saying like, I'm not accustomed to being talked this way. I'm used to getting what I want. I'm very persistent. I'm going to have it happen. I'm going to talk your ear off. And every single turn, Elizabeth has a very good and just and unexpected rebuttal to why she's full of crap. You know, It's like, oh, great. This is what the mother wants. Well, guess what? I mean, he doesn't have an inclination. If he doesn't have the inclination to live up to that promise you guys made, if he's not bound, you know, honor bound to a promise that he did not make that you guys made, then what's the big deal? I am not loyal enough. I do not have reason to be loyal to you. I have no obligation to live up to your guys' promises. Neither does he. And it's so good and satisfying.
And she finally does admit, like, finally Lady Catherine is like, okay, well, just to tell me, are you engaged to him? And Elizabeth doesn't, she finally has to say, you know, like, I'm not engaged. And Lady Catherine's relieved. And then she goes one step further and says, well, you promised me to never enter into this engagement. It's like, why would Elizabeth promise you anything? You just came here and insulted her. You insulted her family. So she's like, I'm not going to make any promise. Like, why would I do that? And it's not so much that she, you know, we know that she's still in love. She's in love with Darcy and that she does want to be engaged to him. But this isn't why she's telling Lady Catherine that she won't promise not be engaged to him. It's because Lady Catherine's just being a jerk. And it's like, why would I give you anything? You've just come here and been awful to me. And she says, you have widely mistaken my character if you think I can be worked on by such persuasions as these. How far your nephew might approve of your interference as hidden affairs, I cannot tell. Elizabeth elevates it and says, knowing what I know of your nephew, he's stubborn too. You think he's gonna like you showing up here and like yelling at me? Like, probably not.
I mean, she calls her out. That's her calling her out, saying like, look, if this is real, then why aren't you talking to him? Why are you playing this like underhanded kind of game here and trying to manipulate things? And then she pulls out the whole thing being like, look, if I make that promise, is that going to actually make his marriage to your daughter happen any more likely? Is he gonna be like, oh, she doesn't love me, I guess I will turn all my affections, oh, here's this one right here? Because I mean, it's not like he is in want of eligible young ladies who want to marry him. He has his pick.
And we've seen him around Lady Catherine's daughter, who maybe is perfectly nice, but she's like sickly and doesn't say anything.
Probably demure. Certainly not the kind of person who would talk back to Lady Catherine like this.
And my favorite line is, are the shades of Pemberley to be thus polluted?
I just always hear Dame Judi Dench and how she says polluted.
I can't do it either, but it's the line reading is perfect.
She punctuates that line so well. And just listening to you like talk about how she was insulting Elizabeth the whole time, it made me think about what a hilarious mirror this is to Darcy's first proposal, where he's insisting that she, well, not insisting, but like being like, hey, you should really marry me, I'm gonna insult you and your family. And now Lady Catherine's seeing the exact opposite, being like, don't marry him for the same exact reasons.
Oh, I love that parallel, because they're both sort of like turning points in the book. Like, first we have this proposal, which turns everything on its head, and then we have a reverse of the situation. So they're really sort of parallel. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a reminder, like, this is the world that Darcy comes from. This is just how they think. And Elizabeth is super aware of it, but she's not going to take it from either of them, not the person that she loves dearly. So she's certainly not going to take it from this lady that she doesn't like anyways.
And then she like kicks her out. She says, you have nothing further to say to me. You've just insulted me in every possible method. You have to get out of my house. And Lady Catherine is still just like, did you not consider that a connection with you would disgrace him in the eyes of everybody? And she's like, just get out of my house. I have nothing further to say to you, which is the ultimate comeback, because there's no way you can come back from that. she's like, and then, and she kind of ends it with this note, like, I'm only resolved to act in that manner which will, in my opinion, constitute my own happiness without reference to you or to any person so wholly connected with you. It's like, I don't care about his friends. I don't care about your daughter. I don't care about you. I'm going to do what makes me happy for me. Like, get out of my house. And it's a really, really powerful moment.
There's this one moment that also reminds me. It reminded me a bit of this moment in Knives Out when Michael Shannon's character is trying to bully the main character, Ana de Armas. Trying to be like, listen, you know, this terrible thing happened to you. My family and all our money would have the resources to fix it for you. And she's like, okay, cool. If that's how it is, then your money is now my money. So I can fix it for myself. And Elizabeth says to all that Lady Catherine is saying to me, like, you know, you're going to be ostracized and looked down upon and no one will want to talk to you. The family will shun you. She says, but the wife of Mr. Darcy must have such extraordinary sources of happiness necessarily attached to her situation that she could, upon the whole, have no cause to repine. She'll be fine. Thank you very much for your concern, Lady Catherine.
Oh, it's so good. And then Lady Catherine just has nothing else to say. So she goes like, I take no leave of you, Miss Bennet. I send no compliments to your mother. You deserve no such attention. I am most seriously displeased. And this reminds me, you've had like very good reminds you of like moments. And this This is not going to be one of those good ones because this reminds me in Mulan, the cartoon version.
Already, it's already great.
Yeah. Mushu the little dragon, he's like trying to convince her to like go along with his plan. And he goes, dishonor, dishonor on you, dishonor on your family, dishonor on your cow.
But it is that level of like ridiculousness. It's so cartoonish where she actually doesn't get something her way. She has no idea how to react. It's just bleh on everyone. I'm gonna go. Bye.
Thank you for taking my ridiculous point and making a very good point.
I will never scoff at a animated Mulan reference ever. It is a classic. Mm-hmm. It is a piece of film history that ought to be revered for the masterpiece that it is. We do not talk about the remake.
That's fair. But now you're never gonna be able to hear that line. Dishonor. Dishonor on you. Dishonor on your cow.
I would like to hear Mushu talking about the shades of, kingdom being thus polluted.
Have Eddie Murphy do the line reading?
Yes, please. Someone make that happen. Thank you and good night.
So anyway, we have Lady Catherine. She's come. She's insulted Elizabeth, but basically sort of given Elizabeth this inkling in the back of her mind. Like, oh, people think that I'm going to get engaged to Mr. Darcy? Like, that's so months ago.
Yeah, like, how did that even happen? It's all a thing.
It is sort of weird. We never really find out like who spread that rumor. And Elizabeth sort of like says to herself in the next chapter, like, oh, with Jane getting married, everyone must sort of be wanting just another wedding. So that's why people are, you know, shipping me and Darcy. but like for Lady Catherine to go all the way there, like I'm really curious sort of who spread the rumor and how certain that rumor was. Because Darcy and Elizabeth are so private.
It had to have had some level of authority and veracity for her to get in the damn carriage and go. Mm-hmm. I think actually it was hinted at in the next chapter when Mr. Bennet gets a letter from Mr. Collins. So I don't know if they were actually like really saying it was going to happen or if they heard it, but it sounded like talking about the engagement, just like Elizabeth had anticipated. Charlotte, being the true blue that she is, was just like, hey, you know, be great. I think Darcy really likes Elizabeth and that should totally happen. And maybe I shouldn't say anything, but...
Are you blaming Charlotte for the rumor? Are you spreading rumors about Charlotte?
Or actually probably, you know what? It was probably her like mentioning it or like idly saying something, being like, oh yeah, that's probably really nice. And Mr. Collins talking about it because he always has to... He's... A big mess. Man.
Can we talk about this letter? This letter is like horrifying.
It hurts.
For many reasons. Like, for many reasons.
So, like, Mr. Bennet is like basically giggling like a schoolgirl with a crush or a gift or something, because this is the best thing to have ever happened to him.
Okay, he's just like, this is ridiculous. Mr. Darcy, you see, is the man. Now, Lizzie, I think I have surprised you. Could he, the Lucases, have pitched on any other man within the circle of our acquaintance whose name would have given the lie more effectually to what they related? Mr. Darcy, who never looks at a woman but to see a blemish, and who probably has never looked at you in his life, it's admirable. And he's laughing, and Elizabeth is like dying inside. He's like, Elizabeth tried to join in her father's pleasantry, but could only force one reluctant smile. Never had his wit been directed in a manner so little agreeable to her. And it's just so horrible, because he's laughing and Elizabeth is dying inside, because like, like she loves him and she's just is being laughed at by her, like the person that she trusts and looks up to most in the world.
She's so embarrassed, and he's, you know, noticing she's not quite as amused. He's like, are you not diverted? Which I hear is like Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Are you not entertained? Because Mr. Bennett's just a joke in my head. Yeah, he thinks it's the funniest thing ever. And Lizzie is like his favorite person to laugh with. And this is the best possible joke, especially if it's coming from Mr. Collins, who is himself an actual joke. Yeah.
There is this weird moment in the letter where Collins sort of reminds them of that it would be not only that it would be a bad idea because Lady de Burgh looks down on the match, but also that everyone knows about Lydia. And he says, you certainly ought to forgive them as a Christian, but never to admit them in your sight or allow their names to be mentioned in your hearing. And Mr. Bennett takes a moment and says, this is his notion of Christian forgiveness. So it's sort of like a weird commentary on religion, like hidden in this letter and reading and hidden in this book, which I thought was interesting, because this book doesn't really talk about religion that much other than it being a good job for like a second son or something.
Mm-hmm. It's like a good job, but also a lot of people who seem to consider it aren't maybe the best people.
Yeah.
Like Wickham or Collins. My favorite part about that, though, is that he's pointing out the hypocrisy in Mr. Collins' reaction to what happened to Lydia. But at the same time, you know, like forgiving them, but never allowing them in your sight or allowing their names to be mentioned or not wanting them to show up at the house. That's exactly what Mr. Bennett wanted to do when they first got married. He's like, nope, they're not allowed at Longbourn.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, but it's less of like a religious Christian thing and more of like just like an anger thing that they like were awful and made him go out and
I think it's just about it. Hypocritical men.
Yeah. Well, the whole book's about hypocritical. I mean,
yeah, true. Fair.
Yeah. And like as the letter goes on, he keeps like doubling down. Like had they fixed on any other man, it would have been nothing, but his perfect indifference and your pointed dislike made it delightfully absurd. And this is like really upsetting because Elizabeth is just sort of denied that he could ever like her again, because she's like, he just keeps coming by and he's so indifferent. And then you have a third party observer being like, how could he possibly like you? He barely even looks at you. And it's just like, so this letter is so painful, and I just feel really bad for Elizabeth to have to endure it.
It's not exactly helping with the insecurity that like, oh, maybe he's changed his mind about me. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, this is a huge problem with keeping everything inside and not sharing them with people, is that she just gets kind of wrapped up more in this lie of omission that she's found herself in.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. And then, you know, Mr. Bennett just so disappointed that he has to keep explaining this joke to her.
Yeah.
You know? For what do we live but to make sport of our neighbors and laugh at them in our turn? And his, you know, his BFF, his one saving grace among this family of women, is just not playing along with him. But I mean, maybe you take the hint, Mr. Bennett.
Yeah. And you have like Elizabeth laying it all out at the end of the chapter, and says, Elizabeth had never been more at a loss to make her feelings appear what they were not. It was necessary to laugh when she would have rather cried. Her father had most cruelly mortified her about what he had said of Mr. Darcy's indifference, and she could do nothing but wonder at such want of penetration, or fear that perhaps, instead of his seeing too little, she might have fancied too much. And it's just really heartbreaking here, because I don't think we've really, like, we've heard Elizabeth complain and be sad and kind of like, be like, oh, you know, like, look back on the moments. But here we really have just how much it's all affecting her. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like she wants to cry. And I don't think we've ever seen this much emotion from mm-hmm. her this entire time. Like, we've seen her be angry, we've seen her be happy, we've seen her be sarcastic and witty and stubborn, but here we have her just sort of admitting to herself and the reader just how devastated she is, and how this letter and her father's picking out these things is just like really salting the wound, and it's really sad.
It is. You always get the image of like Elizabeth Bennet and your other Austen heroes being, or heroines being, sassy, strong, mm-hmm. Upright sort of women who are very like ahead of their time, very modern, but it becomes a very one-dimensional image of a woman. And here you have her being so vulnerable and so alone in it, too, because, like, not even Jane knows what's going on. You know, she's worried. She's doing that thing where, you know, you stand up for yourself, where you face a conflict head on. And now she's just like, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. Maybe Darcy's going to take it the wrong way and think that I expect him to marry me, even though maybe he's not interested. And now, as you said, the person who she is, like, she's loves most and who she relies on is making fun of her, and it really sucks. And I know Mr. Bennet is actually not trying to be mean-spirited right now, he's just trying to get her to laugh, but he's just making it worse.
Yeah, it's a really devastating passage to read, because it's the first time I think we're really seeing the emotional toll on her and how hard it's been to keep this secret, and or the lie of omission, like you said. And so it is funny in some ways, because the letter is just ridiculous, like everything Mr. Collins does. But it really highlights just how big the disconnect Elizabeth feels between her and her family right now.
I mean, it would have been boring if she was not affected by it as she
That's
is.
That's true.
But just really rubbing it in, that's...
But what is nice is we get this really low point, and then, like, immediately the next chapter begins with a proposal. It's, like, sort of whiplash how fast it goes from this really, really low point and this these climactic, I'm looking for a word, like, clashes between people, and then pretty much immediately Bingley and Darcy show up. Kitty bails because she's like too freaked out to talk in front of Darcy, and Elizabeth and Darcy are walking in the countryside together, and Elizabeth is just like, I have to tell you, like, how much that, you know, I know everything, and I know my family doesn't know anything and is being like super rude, but I just need to tell you, like, thank you. And they have this lovely moment.
It's so nice. It's all the things that have been building up until now, and the dam is breaking because Elizabeth, not Darcy, Elizabeth is the one to make the first step and open things up. And I love that she's the one to do it, because he's the one who's been like very like, it's, you know, the Colonel Brandon thing. I'm just going to be here. I'm going to do what I need to do. I want to make you happy. I'm not expecting anything. But hey, since you're bringing it up and all the things that I did, just so you know, it is because I 100% super still love you.
Oh, it's so good. This whole exchange, I mean, I have some sort of issues with it that we can talk about in a second, but I want to really give these whole passages their due, because they're fantastic.
I mean, one I kind of felt bad at, he's just like, oh, you found out about it. I didn't think Miss Gardner was so little to be trusted. And like, oh, buddy, hey, we are not going to be talking ill about my Mrs. Gardner.
Yeah. and Lizzie immediately has to be like, no, it was Lydia. It was all Lydia. Let's
it was Lydia, and then it was me. It was me. And he says to her, you know, if you will thank me, let it be for yourself alone, that the wish of giving happiness to you might add force to the other inducements which led me on, I shall not attempt to deny. But your family owe me nothing. Much as I respect them, I believe I only thought of you.
We need to talk about this. Thank you for the sound effect. The fact that he says, your family owe me nothing, much as I respect them, I believe I only thought of you. There's so much in here. I'm getting like very excited. My hands are waving. Because he says he respects her family. This could not be any more different than the first time he proposes to her, where he just blatantly insulted her entire family. Yes. Here he says, your family, they owe me nothing. I did this for you. I respect them. It's just... And he doesn't need to say any of this. Like, it's so beautiful and so lovely. And it's just so different than the first time they had this conversation. And it just really shows the change the growth that Darcy's had, and I love it. I'm getting very excited.
And, like, there's no conditions to when he says he respects him. He doesn't, like, explain it. It's just he respects him. Probably simply for the mere fact that they are her family. And also, with Lady Catherine de Bourgh having to stop by, it's not like he can really talk about someone's families. I mean, they're very unpleasant on both sides. Let's not talk about it anymore. I get it. I get the whole embarrassing family thing and the talk about propriety. We're just going to focus on you and me, baby, right here.
Beautiful. And then I just picture this moment so clear in my mind. You are too generous to trifle with me. If your feelings are still what they were last April, tell me so at once. My affections and wishes are unchanged, but one word from you will silence me on the subject forever. When I first read this as like a wee child, I was very confused about this passage. I was like, wait, did he propose again? I'm very confused. But when he says my affections and wishes aren't changed, that means he still loves her. He still wants to marry her, but it's very confusing.
It is a little bit, but all that matters is whether or not she wants it. If she doesn't, one word from you will silence me on this subject forever. He wants what she wants. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the sexiest things that any man can offer.
And he'll drop it forever. Like, he won't harass her. He's like, just tell me now and I'll like stop forever. And it's perfect.
He, the richest man in all of Derbyshire, is giving her the power. Okay, I'm shaking now.
We need to keep it together.
Okay. All right. In response, Elizabeth, feeling all the more than common awkwardness and anxiety of the situation, which, same girl, now forced herself to speak, skip ahead. The happiness which this reply produced was such as he had probably never felt before, and he expressed himself on the occasion as sensibly and as warmly as a man violently in love can be supposed to do. Not what you would expect to hear Mr. Darcy described as. Had Elizabeth been able to encounter his eye, she might have seen how well the expression of heartfelt delight diffused over his face became him, but she could not look, and she could listen, and he told her of feelings which, in proving of what importance she was to him, made his affection every moment more valuable.
Ugh, I'm squealing. Like, it's so good. It's so good.
They are talking. They are sharing. They are being open, and they are being vulnerable in a way that they hadn't been before. And in a way, it's so lovely and nice, and communication finally between the two of them.
Yeah. You know, I part of me wishes that we got more of Elizabeth saying the words. Mm-hmm. Like, we get Elizabeth describing it, but we never get Elizabeth saying, like, yes, I accept your proposal. Like, I love you. Like, we don't get that. We just get her being like, no, there's been a change. And then him just being so happy. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for me to say I don't like it, because I obviously do. And I love this description of how happy he is and how, like, he's never been this happy. It's just really, it is lovely.
It is.
Even if it's not dialogue heavy, I guess.
And we do get so much dialogue later from the two of them, which is also mm-hmm. a lot of fun. So, I mean, and I think this happened before in Sense and Sensibility, where, you know, we know that conversations were had. We didn't really get the specifics of it, but we get stuff after that makes up for it.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the, I was reading some essays and some analysis that had been done on Jane Austen, and because these are romances, like most of her books end in proposals and marriage, mm-hmm. we rarely get successful proposals like laid out. Mm-hmm. Like, she almost sort of glosses over successful ones, and unsuccessful ones, we get the exact dialogue. Like, Mr. Collins' proposal and Mr. Darcy's first proposal, we get like the exact play-by-play. Meanwhile, in Sense and Sensibility and also here, we get smoothed over. So it's sort of interesting.
It is. I mean, we mostly get like the emotions and everything and the circumstances and the internal stuff instead of the actual words, which, I mean, I guess in a lot of ways don't matter. And right mm-hmm. after it says, they walked on without knowing in what direction. There was too much to be thought and felt and said for attention to any other objects. And honestly, I think that perfectly explains why you don't need the words. They're just so full of their feelings and happiness and joy that, like, I don't know, it's just so many things right now. We're just together and it's all that matters. Okay. Yay.
And which was even like the best. I mean, even after all of this, we get Elizabeth Banks, so what happened? And he basically tells her that it was because of Lady Catherine. Lady Catherine, who schlepped all the way to Llanborin to basically harass Elizabeth and get her to promise that she wouldn't be engaged to Darcy, was the one that came back. And as Darcy says, it taught me to hope, as he said, as I scarcely ever allowed myself to hope before. I knew enough of your disposition to be certain that, had you been absolutely irrevocably decided against me, you would have acknowledged it to Lady Catherine, Franklin, and openly. And Elizabeth is like, you know enough about me to believe me capable of that. After abusing you so abominably to your face, I could have no scruple in abusing you to your relations.
A very good line. Indeed. And again, Mr. Darcy, knowing exactly what to say, what did you say of me that I did not deserve? That, good point. Good point.
Injected into my veins. He learned.
He admits that he's wrong. He's aware. Awareness.
Although your accusations were ill-founded, form on mistaken premises, my behavior to you at the time had merited the severest reproof. I was unpardonable. I cannot think of it without abhorrence. And she even like gives him an out. She says like, we're both uncivil. Like, it's fine. And he goes, no, like, I can't be so easily reconciled to myself. Like, the recollection of what I said, my conduct, my manners, my expressions during the whole of it, it has been many months inexpressibly painful to me. Your approach so well applied, I shall never forget. Had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner, those were your words. You know not, you could scarcely conceive how they've tortured me. Though sometime, I confess before, I was reasonable enough to allow their justice. He's just so, he lays it all out. He admits it. He was like, I was very defensive. I was very upset. I was very angry. But then I thought about it and I realized that, no, you were right. And then he went about fixing mm-hmm. it. And not fixing it because he wanted her to love him again. Fixing it because he saw the flaws in himself and wanted to grow as a person and be a good person in her mm-hmm. eyes. And it's so important, I think.
He almost goes a little too far being explaining why he was wrong and then being like really insecure about the letter. And he's just like, when I wrote that letter, I believed myself perfectly calm and cool. But since I am convinced that it was written in a dreadful bitterness of spirit. But the thing is, if it wasn't, I don't think it would have landed as well. I think being that open, more emotional, honest, vulnerable person, that's going to also help convince that, no, these things that you feel, the things that you believe and the way you act actually do have some real justification. I think he's just being hard on himself now. No, this is the part that mm-hmm. she likes, this part where you're like admitting stuff. And she tells him, you know, the feelings of the person who wrote and the person who received it are now so wildly different from what they were then that every unpleasant circumstance intending it ought to be forgiven. You must learn some of my philosophy. Think only of the past as its remembrance gives you pleasure. That's where I think she's like, all right, we're good now. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. We are here now. I am here in front of you in love with you.
But I love the introspection too, because he like extrapolates not only from this moment, but he like goes back in time mm-hmm. and goes, I've been a selfish being all my life and practiced though not in principle. I was given good principles, but left to follow them in pride and conceit. Unfortunately, as the only son for many years and only child, I was fooled by my parents who, though good themselves, almost taught me to be selfish and overbearing, to care for none behind my own family circle, to think mainly meanly of all the rest of the world. To wish to think meanly of their sense and worth compared to my own. Since I was from 8 to 8 and 20, and such I must still might have been, but not for you, dearest, loveliest Elizabeth. What do I not owe you? You taught me a lesson, hard indeed at first, but most advantageous. By you, I was properly humbled. I came to you without a doubt of my reception. You showed me how insufficient were all my pretenses to please a woman worthy of being pleased. And this is how you know a woman wrote this book.
Yes, 100%. Up until the part about talking about Elizabeth and how he, you know, taught her a lesson and everything, I'm like, oh, I'm weirdly relating to Darcy really hard right now. This is 100% female gaze right here. Not only is he tall and rich and handsome, he is all these wonderful things. He's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but he recognizes it and also understands that he is capable of being more than that.
And because we're in Elizabeth's POV, we've gotten a lot, mostly. I mean, we've talked about the few instances where we've gone back and forth. But this book is mostly from Elizabeth's point of view, especially in the later chapters. And so we get a lot of Elizabeth recognizing a lot of the faults within herself. Mm-hmm. And we get her being like, I saw what I wanted to see. I, you know, jumped to conclusions. I refused to see the facts in these situations. I was prejudiced against him. And so we see how she's grown. But here we get Darcy really laying it out for us. Not so much how he's changed, but how he's grown as a person. She never told him, like, you are a selfish person. She never told him, like, you were raised wrong. It took her saying, no, I'm not going to accept your marriage proposal because you're being rude about it, for him to think, to look within himself and grow and make these changes by himself and come to these conclusions for himself. And I think that's a huge distinction. She didn't tell him what to do. She didn't tell him how to change. He didn't change. He grew as a person. And I think that's an extraordinarily important distinction to make, because people can't change, but they can grow and learn. I just think it's so important that we could all learn a lesson.
So this was something that I was thinking of when I was reading this, because there you get the accusations that the story is just about, like, a man being changed for the better through a woman's love and everything. But are you saying that this is pointing to why this is different? It's actually not just like, oh, I can make him better. I like this guy who's terrible.
Yeah, I think there's like a difference between being told what to do and then coming to the conclusion by yourself and learning on your own how better to treat people and to realize your own issues and how they came about so you can go about fixing them. I think change and growth are related, but he's not making a 180 here. He's still the same person that he always was. He still is very privileged and grew up in this world, but he's able now to see that if he wants something, someone like Elizabeth, then he has to recognize these issues in himself. Like, he loves the gardeners, right? This book ends with them saying, the gardeners are such wonderful people, we love them. But, you know, he grew up like a couple blocks away or miles away from Mrs. Gardner. And he never knew her family. And, like, he never would have known them, never would have been close to them had he not met Elizabeth and sort of changed the way he views things. Yeah, I think it's important for him to have come to these conclusions on his own. I don't think Elizabeth tells him what to do. She doesn't tell him how to change. She just tells him the way he's treating her is not acceptable.
And it's not like conditional. It's not like, I will be good if you love me kind of thing. It's like, no, you reminded me that, like, I know what's right and wrong, but because I was spoiled and I was just allowed to be kind of a brat about it, and I was being this morally superior individual to everyone but not actually living up to it, you're just like, you just reminded me of my own personal, like, standards of what I expect a person to be and apply them to myself.
And he says to her that he's not making, when he sees her at Pemberley, I think this is maybe in a later chapter, in chapter 60, when she came to visit at Pemberley, his real purpose was not to make her, like, fall in love with him back in, like, in love with him at first. It was just to, like, show her that he took what she said to heart and was going to be nice and polite and convince her that he's working on himself. But I mean, eventually he sees her and he's like, yeah, like, I'm still in love with her. Like, I gotta have her. But he's not he's not growing and making these changes to marry her necessarily. It's more to show her that he can grow. So I think that's the distinction.
I like that. It's showing that you can, you know, you are that better version of yourself. And almost like it's, you know, he's going through 12 steps or anything. He also talks about how he apologized and came clean with Mr. Bingley and rectified his mistake there, and even admits that, you know, I figured that they'd get engaged because I was like, hey, Bingley, this is what happened. Jane really was in town. I'm sorry I didn't tell you. This is what I felt. And now that I'm, like, watching Jane, I'm seeing it right here that, no, she's super into you, dude. That was my bad. That was my fault. I'm sorry.
I like how Elizabeth's like, so you did it. And he's like, no, I didn't do it. She's like, yeah, you did. You gave your permission. And he's like, no, I just explained what happened. And then she doesn't say anything. She's like, okay. Elizabeth longed to observe that Mr. Bingley had been a most delightful friend, so easily guided that his worth was invaluable. But she checked herself. She remembered that he had yet to learn to be laughed at, and it was rather too early to begin.
Oh, she knows him. She's like, no, I'll make fun of him later.
Yeah, it's very cute.
It is. It's not just like we have a lot of feelings and a lot of good banter and stuff. It's like, no, there's actually like I see him. There's a lot of affection there. And just the thought of each, just the kind of joy that the thought of the other person and who they are gives them. And that's so cute. Oh, my God.
But so it's they're settled, right? But we still have Tell the Family. So we get, I think, this delightful chapter where Elizabeth has to talk to first
literally
Jane,
everyone.
Then her dad, and then her mom, and has to continue to explain how something like this could happen. Yeah. And they're all just shocked. And so she tells, yeah.
I really like this line. The acknowledged lovers talked and laughed, and the unacknowledged were silent. Darcy was not of a dispassion in which happiness overflows in mirth, which I thought was hilarious. Like, yeah, that's a understatement. And Elizabeth, agitated and confused, rather knew that she was happy than felt herself to be so, which is kind of a bummer, because like this is a time you want to be like happy and celebrate, but they're like, oh, so much stuff first to deal with. Not able to be happy yet.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that line, because it shows like the differences between them and how anxious Elizabeth is to talk to everyone.
Well, because I mean, she's been keeping this secret from everyone and carrying it on her own, which it's not the first time we've seen this sister being strong for everyone else and keeping everything inside and causing herself much more suffering, which is a little martyr-y, but this is where we are. Even Jane was like super duper surprised. She literally could not accept it. She's like, you are joking, Lizzie. This cannot be real. Engaged to Mrs. Darcy? No. You shall not deceive me. I know it to be impossible.
I know. Even I was sort of surprised by how much Jane was like in denial about it. I was like, Jane, like your sister's telling you she's, just take her word for it.
I mean, a lot of it is just like Elizabeth has to admit that not only is she like in love and about to get engaged, she has to be like, hey, the times I was incredibly stubbornly, passionately disliking someone and trash talking him and all that stuff, I was wrong. No, I gotta take that.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Incredibly humbling. I mean, it was very humbling for Darcy to be for everything that he did with Bingley and his aunt and everything, but this is her time where she just be like, yeah, no, I was wrong too. I said a lot of stuff I shouldn't have said. I felt a lot of things that I shouldn't have said. I misjudged someone. I'm not as smart as I like to act that I was.
There's some really great lines here. It's like, perhaps I did not always love him as well as I do now, but in such cases as these, a good memory is unpardonable. This is the last time I shall ever remember it myself. And she just like refuses to be serious. And Janie's like, you need to like be serious. Like, tell me what's going on. Like, when did you love him? And she goes, well, I believe I must date it from my first meeting of his beautiful grounds at Pemberley.
That part made me laugh so much. You're like, okay, right. I mean, we're trying to say that it's because of who they are as people, but also mostly she saw his land and it was a good bit of land.
It's the bell in the library moment of Beauty
yes,
and the Beast.
You're like, oh, yeah. I could live there. And Jane really just wants to make sure that she's actually like happy. Mm-hmm. And I love...
Jane's a good sister.
She is. And I love the certainty with which Elizabeth is like, there can be no doubt of that. It is settled between us already that we are to be the happiest couple in the world. But are you pleased, Jane? Shall you like to have such a brother? Which is very sweet of her.
And I like how Jane's like, well, me and Bingley ship it, of course. But like, we just figured it wasn't going to happen. So we didn't say anything.
Yeah. They're like, that'd be nice. But obviously, no. She also tells her, do anything rather than marry without affection. And I just, Jane, so pure and so sweet.
She knows her sister so well. And it's something that, like, she hears again from her father. Just like, I couldn't bear to see you in a relationship with someone that you didn't actually love. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth has to just be like, no. She says, how earnestly did she wish then that her former opinions had been more reasonable, her expressions more moderate. It would have spared her from explanations and professions, which it was exceedingly awkward to give.
Yeah.
Oh, that I think that's when she was having the conversation with her dad, still.
But, like, I mean, if she wasn't that passionate about her feelings before, she wouldn't be the person that Darcy fell in love with.
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
It is cute that when Darcy and Elizabeth wanted to talk one more time before being like, this is the plan, this is how we're going to get the consent and everything, one, Bingley is just trying to get Darcy and Elizabeth on a walk together, and Mrs. Bennett tries to say, she's just like, well, I'm sorry, you guys should walk with Mr. Darcy again so that he doesn't get in the way of Bingley and Jane. Sorry about that. I know it's going to make you miserable, but whatever, just do it. Thanks, bye. Don't try too hard.
Oh, I love Miss Benatir. Ugh, I'm sorry, so Liz, funny. That you have to be forced to have that disagreeable man all to yourself. And Lizzie's like, ugh, okay. I guess I'm going to have to bear it. Like,
And then they're like, well, Kitty can walk with him too. And Bingley's just like, oh, I'm sure that nice walk will be too much for Kitty. Won't it, Kitty? And it's a good thing that he was winking at her too, because then it would have been like the whole situation with Mrs. Bennett, where she's like, why are you, what are you, what do you want me to do, Mama?
And poor Kitty, she's like, keeps being like used. Even later, like after Darcy goes to ask her father's consent, he like comes out and like pretends to look at Kitty's drawing and is like, go talk to your father. All
right, bye. No. And Mr. Bennett is also just as confused by the whole thing. I mean, he sees like, yeah, I mean, he's like, Lizzie, I have given him my consent. He's the kind of man indeed to whom I should never dare refuse anything which he condescend to ask. I now give to you, if you are resolved on having him, but let me advise you to think better of it. I know your disposition, Lizzie. I know that you could neither be happy nor respectable unless you truly esteemed your husband, unless you looked up to him as a superior. Your lively talents would place you in the greatest danger in an unequal marriage, which is seems like a foreign concept in these times, you know, wanting an equal marriage. You could scarcely escape discredit and misery. My child, let me not have the grief of seeing you unable to respect your partner in life. You know not what you are about. And part of me was thinking when I heard this, that's actually like pretty wonderful. He wants her to be respected and seen as an equal in his marriage. And another part of me is just like, are you talking from experience, Mr. Bennett?
Oh, he definitely is. Yeah. It's, you know, one of the things that's changed the most as I've grown up with this book is my perception of Mr. Bennett. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this, just like how when I was maybe younger in my first readings of this book, I, you know, loved Mr. Bennett so much. I was like, oh, Miss Bennett sucks. Like, Mr. Bennett's the best. Like, what a great dad. And my understandings of both him and Miss Bennett have grown a lot. And obviously, one of the things now I look now at Mr. Bennett and I see a lot more of his flaws, you know, the sarcasm, the bitterness. Indifference, the bitterness. Yeah. But like, this is one of those scenes I think that really stands out with just him. I mean, Lizzie's his favorite daughter, so it's not like he's like still like a great father to everybody or even to Elizabeth, but this is a really good father daughter moment that I really like. And it's really just like him just constantly being like, do you love him? Like, it's really important to me that you are happy. Yeah. Like, he's rich for sure. You'll have more fine carriages, more fine clothes than Jane, but like, will you be happy? And Elizabeth says, well, have you any other objections than your belief that I'm indifferent? He goes, none. We know him to be a proud and pleasant man, but this would be nothing if you really liked him. And it's such an important thing for him. You know, he's like, I love you and I trust you. Do you love him? And I'm sorry, I'm ranting. One of the things that I think is really important in Elizabeth convincing her dad is that she doesn't start with the fact that he's the one that saved the family. Mm-hmm. Instead, she starts with telling him how much she loves him.
She actually says separately, I like him and I love him, which I think are really, it's such a nice distinction, because I mean, like, love is great. But to actually like him, that they get on, that is, those two things combined, that is such a good recipe for being happy with the person you're with. I mean, she also says in the same breath that he's perfectly amiable, which is slightly less impassioned, but I'm going to go with it.
I really, really like this scene for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree. Well, the first one is her just, I like him and I love him. You don't know who he really is. You know, it pains me to even hear you say anything less. And so she finally is able, you know, she explains the gradual change. And he says, if this may the case may be, he deserves you. I could not have parted you with you, my Lizzie, to anyone less worthy. Then, now that she's got him, now that he like fully approves, then she explains to him how Darcy saved, you know, Lydia's reputation and paid off Wickham and everything like that. So she could have started with that. She could have been like, this is what we owe him. You know, like, you owe him your gratitude. You owe him my hand in marriage. Yeah. But instead, she convinces him that she loves him. And then she just, like, topping on the cake or whatever.
Doesn't the person that he is and what they're owed to him doesn't matter nearly as much as how she feels for him. And that's, it's something I don't see very often in the adaptations, but it's such a really nice fine line on everything. And I just really appreciate that. And then, you know, Mr. Bennett, of course, has to be kind of funny again.
How I love this. I know exactly what you're going to say, and I love it.
I shall offer to pay him tomorrow. He will rant. Oh, so like he's like, if it was, you know, if it was your uncle who did all that, I would pay him back, you know, all of it. But since it's Darcy, you know, I shall offer to pay him tomorrow, and he'll rant and storm about his love for you, and there will be an end of the matter. It's kind of cruel and cold, but it's also like really economical on his part.
Oh, it's so funny. And, like, we know he was never going to pay his brother or the Mr. Gardner back. So it's just even funnier. Yeah.
And then he remembers how she reacted to the letter from Collins and, after laughing at her for some time, allowed her to go, saying as she quitted the room, "If any young men come for Mary Kitty, send them in, for I am quite at my leisure."
I love this. I think about the 2005 movie with Donald Sutherland saying that. It's a good moment.
It's the most relaxed image.
Yeah. And then we get Elizabeth telling Mrs. Bennet.
It's just such word vomit.
It's so good, though. It's just like speechless.
This is Mrs. Bennet speechless, where it's just a million words at a time about, like, I mean, she's incredibly relieved, so much more than how happy she was about Lydia getting married and then Jane becoming her next favorite. You know, now we have her brand new absolute top favorite, for now at least. You know, good gracious, Lord bless me, only think, dear me, Mr. Darcy, who would have thought it? And is it really true? Oh, my dear sweet, or my sweetest Lizzie, how rich and great you will be, what pin money, what jewels, what carriages you will have. Jane's is nothing to it, nothing at all. I am so pleased, so happy, so charming, so handsome, so tall. Oh, my dear Lizzie, pray apologize for my having disliked him so much before. I hope you will overlook it, dear, dear Lizzie. A house in town, everything that's charming, 3 daughters married, 10,000 a year. Oh, Lord, what will become of me? I shall go distracted. And absolutely nothing about Lizzie being happy.
I love the so tall.
I mean, yes, that is something my own mother would say, too, in fairness.
Oh, it's so good. I had to look up what being married by a special license meant, because I was like, what is that? So I found these, like, antiquated rules of marriage because there were only 3 legitimate ways to get married in England, through the Church of England, really. If you got married by special license, basically that means you obtained it from the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the biggest difference between a special license and a common license was the cost. Over 20 guineas plus £4 to £5 stamp duty for the paper, and that the couple could be married at any time of the day and anywhere they wanted. All the requirements were the same. So that's the difference between a special license. For those of you curious.
I was curious. Thank you. And then I forgot to look it up.
Yeah, so if you were married by just a common license, any clergyman of the Church of England could issue it to you for a few shillings to a pound, and it was valid for 15 days, and the couple could marry in either one of their parishes. And there were other stipulations, like the resident of the marrying parish and a sworn statement to be given by both. There were no impediments to the marriage. So special license is very fancy.
It is very fancy, but when you make 10,000 a year, why not?
Very true. They should get, I wonder if they did get married by special license.
And so the whole time, like, Elizabeth was just like, oh no, this is a sad omen of what her mother's behavior to the gentleman himself might be. But thankfully, she's like just so in awe, she actually was just like managed to contain herself.
I love that so much.
And just showed him a lot of like deference and attention and positive, but like never being like overbearing, like, no, we got you now, I'll just be nice, I guess. And Elizabeth also had the satisfaction of seeing her father take pains to get acquainted with him. Mr. Bennet soon assured her that he was rising every hour in his esteem. I admire all my 3 sons-in-law highly. Wickham perhaps is my favorite, but I think I shall like your husband quite as well as Jane's.
So funny.
I like that favorite and liking them is different.
Yeah. It's very good. I think chapter 60 is like just sort of fun. You get like some more banter, and then chapter 61 is sort of like an epilogue just giving us like after the happily ever after.
Yeah.
But I love it so much.
I mean, they're great. We don't have to get too deep into them, but they're just.
Yeah, I know. We've already been talking for like an hour.
I know. But there's so much. I mean, it was 6 chapters instead of 5.
I know. Just read the book.
I like that in chapter 60, we start off with just, it says, you know, Elizabeth's spirit soon rising to playfulness again. She wanted Mr. Darcy to count for his having ever fallen in love with her. And this line is so good. You know, I cannot fix on the hour or the spot or the look or the words which laid the foundation. It is too long ago. I was in the middle before I knew I had begun.
I also love when she says, you might have talked to me more when you came to dinner, and he says, a man who felt less might.
Oh yeah, I think I had that one down too. And then
it's like every line is like, oh my heart,
the whole thing is just such sweet conversation. And this is a lot of the same like kind of banter chemistry they had earlier on, but it's so much sweetness and affection and love, and you know, no defensiveness, no ego. It's just a lot of fun. You can tell that they are going to enjoy themselves.
And there's some more letter writing. Oh, so much friggin'
letter. So they had, someone had to write Lady Catherine and let her know this is going down. So that's up to Darcy. That's his aunt. And I think it said somewhere where she's like, I would love to have like stood over his shoulder and watched the whole thing, but I have an aunt too that I haven't.
That was my burn. And that was one of my burns.
Mine too.
So I'll read the whole quote.
Because Elizabeth had to write Mrs. Gardner, her own aunt. It's been like 3 whole days and she didn't tell her what happened.
I love the letter she writes her aunt, though. Like, it's just silliness. You know, thank you so much for not going to the lakes. And then her saying, you know, we're going to go around the park every day. I'm the happiest creature in the world. I'm happier even than Jane. She only smiles. I laugh.
That line. That, it's so good.
Mr. Darcy sends you all the love in the world that he can spare from me. You were all to come to Pemberley at Christmas.
That one, I think, was my favorite one. It's just so, it's not very Elizabeth, who is so matter of fact, I think, in her letters and everything and trying to take care of people. But this is almost more Lydia-like and frivolous and fun and just fantasizing and making promises about this future marriage that she's going to have. But, you know, it's obviously more grounded. It's just so nice. Mr. Bennet writes the Collinses a letter. It's very short, being like, Elizabeth soon will be little wife of Mr. Darcy. Console Lady Catherine as well as you can. But if I were you, I would stand by the nephew. He has more to give.
I think I had that as a burn too. It's so good.
Miss Bingley wrote a letter to Jane, which Jane didn't buy, but she still wrote back a much kinder answer than she knew was deserved. Georgiana wrote a letter. 4 sides of paper were insufficient to contain all her delight and all her earnest desire of being loved by her sister. Charlotte is so happy about the marriage, and Lady Catherine so angry that they decided to visit the Lucases for a bit. That's probably for the best. Just stay out of the blast range for a while.
I do. I like this. You know, Elizabeth has to like watch Darcy like deal with all this. You know, he handles it very well with an admirable calmness. And she says, if he did shrug his shoulders, it was not till Sir William was out of his sights. So Darcy's behaving himself.
He's being very good. He's being very good. He recognizes that his family is a little flawed too. Mrs. Phillips was very vulgar about everything, worse than Mrs. Bennet. Elizabeth did all she could to shield him from the frequent notice of either, and was ever anxious to keep him to herself and to those of her family with whom he might converse without mortification.
So they're both sort of on the same page, which is good. They're like, okay, we can't wait till we can like say goodbye and peace off to Pemberley.
We love our family, but let's not spend any time with them.
And then we get this beautiful last chapter, which I really think is more like an epilogue. You know, happy for all her maternal feelings was the day on which Mrs. Bennet got rid of her two most deserving daughters. It's just, it's a very, you know, it's sort of a very matter-of-fact way to tie up all the loose ends. You have Mrs. Bennet, who, you know, is happy that she has more daughters married. You have Mr. Bennet, who misses the second daughter exceedingly, and his affection for her draws him more often from home than anything could do, and he delights in showing up at Pemberley when he's least expected.
There was one part with Mrs. Bennet that I was really amused by. It's the only part in which the narrator of the story, in this third-person narrative story, switches to first-person, you know, third-person, first-person point of view as a separate from the story, going, I wish I could say for the sake of her family that the accomplishment of her earnest desire and the establishment of so many of her children produced so happy an effect as to make her a sensible, amiable, well-informed woman for the rest of her life. though perhaps it was lucky for her husband, who might not have relished domestic felicity in so unusual form, that she's still occasionally nervous and invariably silly. And it was like, of all the times for the narrator to jump in and be a part of it, it's like about Mrs. Bennett being like, I wish I could tell you that everything, that Mrs. Bennett was fine finally.
I just have to let you know that everything's fine and happy, but Mrs. Bennett's still
Mrs. Bennett.
Silly. Yeah, Mrs. Bennett.
Mr. Bennett wouldn't know what to do with it anyways. What else? The Bingleys only stayed at Netherfield for a year, so near vicinity to her mother and Meryton relations was not desirable even to his easy temper or her affectionate heart. Oh, gosh. But that means they're also now, they're like less than 30 miles away from the Darcys because they're best. Everyone's best friends. That's like the dream.
And I like how Kitty, to her very material advantage, spent the chief of her time with her two elder sisters in society so superior to what she had generally known, her improvement was great. She became, by proper attention and management, less irritable, less ignorant, and less insipid. Ouch.
Yeah. Which, I mean, this also could have just been her growing up and also being away from Lydia's influence, which is exactly what everyone wanted, even though Mrs. Wickham kept inviting Kitty up with the promise of balls and young men, but Mr. Bennett never allowed it, which is for the best. And also just being around higher society, but also just the more collected and reasonable presence of Jane and Elizabeth, away from all the ideas that Mrs. Bennett was putting in her heads and all the putting down that Mr. Bennett was probably doing. I'm just saying, it's not just Kitty.
No, it's true. And even, and you know, someone else I've been sort of hard on through this read is Mary. Mm-hmm. You know, Mary sort of like embarrasses herself and goes on and on. And I know someone we were talking to was saying that someone wrote a book about Mary and, you know, that sort of felt bad for her. And, you know, Mary sort of made me kind of irritated when Lydia went off and Mary was calling her names and not being very helpful. So I've never been that fond of Mary. But there's a line here where it says that she was no longer mortified by comparisons between her sister's beauty and her own. So that sort of gave me, in that one sentence, a little bit more background or color maybe to Mary, to why Mary is the way she is. And so I felt a little bit bad for her.
She was the most middle of middle children.
Yeah, yeah. So I sort of understand a little bit more why she might be the way she is.
Mm-hmm. Now she's got a little more of the attention. Everything's a lot quieter. And the pressure to get married is also a lot lessened, so she's fine. Mm-hmm. The Wickhams did not learn their lesson about...
The Wickhams still gonna Wickham.
Yeah, in many ways, they are just perfect for each other in that they're both terrible for each other and themselves. As for Wickham and Lydia, their character suffered no revolution from the marriage of her sisters. Mostly it's just that whenever they need to leave from a new place because their debts have mounted up so high, they just write to one of their sisters now asking for some cash. Lydia even has the audacity to write, I'm sure Wickham would like a place at court very much, and I do not think we shall have quite enough money to live upon without some help. Any place would do, of about 300 or 400 a year, but however, do not speak to Mr. Darcy about it if you would rather not. And as it happened, that Elizabeth had much rather not. I love that, but, you know, she's still going to care about her sister and give her some money, which is...
Yeah, it is nice that...
Yeah. I mean, you don't want her to see someone enable, but she has more than enough money that she is actually able to help them. As long as Wickham never visits, he's not allowed.
Did you read the part about how they stay with the Bingleys so long that even Bingley's good humor was overcome and he proceeded to go so far as to hint that they would be gone?
Yeah, I mean, Jane and Bingley are the nicest people, but they are also not so people-pleasing enough that they're going to let the leeches hook on indefinitely. Which, yeah. I love. I do like that. You know, we've talked about before, Bingley's seems like a bit of a pushover sometimes, but nah. I mean, he has all that money. He's got to take care of it somehow.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. And then we get, you know, Miss Bingley's even sort of livened up a bit. She's nice to Georgiana. Georgiana loves having a sister, which I absolutely adore. Mm-hmm. And Georgiana had the highest opinion in the world of Elizabeth, though at first she only listened with astonishment, bordering on alarm at her lively, sportive manner of talking to her brother.
I love this part.
And by Elizabeth's instruction, she began to comprehend that a woman may take liberties with her husband, which a brother will not always allow in a sister more than 10 years younger than himself.
It's so nice that this is the example that Georgiana has of a married couple who really loves each other. And with everything she's gone through and how nervous she is, it's nice that she's able to see people just be excited and have fun and actually like each other.
Yeah.
And now she has a sister.
Aww. And I love how, you know, even Lady Catherine is still being a huge jerk, but it's Elizabeth who sort of convinces Darcy to let her back in and open the lines of communication again. So it was just a very nice picture of their married life, you know, him like wanting to stand up for her and be defensive of her and being like, thank you, but, you know, she's part of your family.
Mm-hmm. Family is the most important to Elizabeth, even though Lady Catherine sent him language so very abusive, especially of Elizabeth, that for some time all intercourse is at an end.
And then, of course, the Gardeners, they're still very close to the Gardeners. And it's just like a very nice epilogue chapter, letting us know that it's happily ever after for them. And, you know, not everyone hasn't necessarily changed and become totally different. It's just lovely.
It is. I love that the last thing we hear is about the Gardeners, who have been basically the best parents in this whole thing. They were such a point of contention for Elizabeth because she's just like, they're such good people. Darcy will never accept them because of their social economic status, and that they are just among the most welcome to the home, as that, you know, the final point of a very long statement is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It sort of like unceremoniously ends. And I think we had a similar reaction to the end of Sense and Sensibility too. Like, it's almost like she doesn't really know how to end a story. So she just like ends it.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful that these are like the thoughts that you're left with on a story about how people are seeing each other, about different classes and everything. It's just nice. I think a lot of it is where you expect things to lead up to, and a lot of it leaves you in a really good place after all the ups and downs that we've come through.
But yeah, so I have like pages and pages here about the themes and the analysis and talking about class and reputation and family and gender, but I don't know. I mean, we've talked a lot about the book and the words on paper, and we still have another episode to talk about the adaptions, and I think we've kind of covered most of the big things. What are your thoughts on it?
Oh yeah, God knows we've covered a lot of it. I think in general it's just a really nice story about being true to yourself and knowing your own worth and humility and self-awareness and the importance of love. I think I mentioned it once before. There was a moment in the show called, oh gosh, Zoe's Amazing Playlist or whatever that show's called, where one of the characters says, it's a musical, it's glorious. I had a lot of feelings. I would recommend it. And at one point, one of the characters says, you know, hurt people hurt people. And I think that is something that we see a lot of in this. And you see a lot of people with goodness and forgiveness and love and how that spreads too, and that comes back to them. And that's just, it's just nice, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think I read in some of the discussions online that one of the critiques of the end of the novel is that it becomes kind of simplistic, that Darcy's character changes almost too drastically from an arrogant figure at the opening pages. But I really think that we talked a lot about the growth and the changes that he makes in that respect. And both of them really go through a journey in this that doesn't really feel super rushed to me, even if I do kind of see the tide at the end with a neat little bow in a lot of ways that some parts are.
Yeah, it's just a little messy. Families are going to be embarrassing.
Yeah, and I do want to like say, you know, we love this book. Like, I love almost everything about it. And that one of the themes of the novel is class and the class between Elizabeth and Darcy. But it's very much like a middle to upper class sort of conversation. Austen doesn't really talk about like the lower classes and the servants and doesn't really criticize the overall class structure, mm-hmm. and sort of has this message of like love can conquer all, which doesn't really feel like a fairy tale to me. Like, I think it does talk about like really real issues.
Yeah.
But I do sort of just want to like point it out.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Elizabeth even says when she's talking to Lady Catherine, she's like, I am a gentleman's daughter. My mother's side, a little questionable, but it still doesn't change the fact that like, no, we're on the same standing, even though I don't have the money he does. Mm-hmm. I will say though that, the part where she's talking about like their bloodlines and everything like that and preserving all those things, it did remind me of Frances Delator in the Enola Holmes movie, where she's talking about, you know, that we are tasked with protecting all the old stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're like, well, she was a villain in the end. So, spoiler, sorry. So it's not a good look, Lady C, gotta say.
Oh, we didn't do our burns yet.
Burns. Okay. So
we did do go through most of them. So
yes, I didn't. Hold on. Do you want to go first?
Yes. So I'm going to pick my favorite ones that we didn't talk about. Both of mine are in the same. My favorites are in the same chapter. Chapter 60. Elizabeth says, Lady Catherine has been of such infinite mm-hmm. use, which ought to make her happy, for she loves to be of use.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, you should absolutely tell Lady Catherine that she brought you two together.
Yeah, rub it in. I think I had that too. That one's so good.
And then the other one is one that you sort of alluded to when they're about to write their letters. Elizabeth says, and if I had not a letter to write myself, I might sit by you and admire the evenness of your writing as another lady once did. But I have an aunt too who must no longer be neglected. And it's so mean to Miss Bingley.
It's like Miss Bingley. We're very aware. I think like mostly she's making fun of him, but it's a nice callback. It's a great callback. I think I had those marked just because they're also just they're such good lines. I had so many in the interaction with Lady Catherine de Bourgh. I think those were among my favorites. When maybe we mentioned it, I don't remember now. It was so long ago. It was like an hour and a half ago.
I know. When we're like rushing to finish.
When Lady Catherine was like, I know there's no way it's possible that Darcy would want to get engaged with you. It wouldn't happen at all. And Elizabeth's just like, if you believed it to be true, I wonder you took the trouble of coming so far. What could your ladyship propose by it? I'm like, I see what you're doing there. Like, you're just calling her out on her ridiculousness. And I love it.
Some very good burns, these chapters.
So, I mean, we're not quite done with Pride and Prejudice just yet. We've got at least one more episode going. Next time, we'll be talking adaptations. Jesse, would you like to share some of what we'll be covering next time?
Yeah, so I think the biggest things that we're going to be covering, like if I were to give anyone homework to make sure that you are up to date for our discussion next time, the things I think we are going to cover the most are the 1995 BBC miniseries, the one with Colin Firth, and the 2005 movie with Keira Knightley. So those are the things we're probably going to discuss the most. And they're, I think right now, the movie's on Netflix, so you can watch that on streaming. We're also going to talk about the 1940 Pride and Prejudice with Laurence Olivier, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, which is available on YouTube, right, Annie?
Yes, it is all on YouTube. It's all got its own channel. It's all for free. I think there's some Lydia stuff that's on a separate channel, so sometimes it can be a little hard to jump back and forth. I don't think you're missing too much if you don't necessarily watch them, you know, manage to jump back and forth in time. There's some really good stuff with Mary and Kitty too. Or you could do what I did and just buy the box set off of eBay.
Oh yeah, I highly recommend that. Or have a very good friend who gives it to you. And so I'm going to talk about Pride and Prejudice, which you can rent on Amazon, and I highly recommend you do. Bridget Jones's Diary, of course. We're going to talk about some books, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Death Comes to Pemberley, both of which have a movie and a miniseries adaptation. So yeah, there's lots of adaptions. Those are the biggest ones we're going to focus on, but we're going to mainly focus on the miniseries and the movie. So, yeah, lots of fun talk. Some surprises too. We got to like build it up.
I know. Got to come back, guys. We can't give you everything right now. Come on. So feel free to do some homework, have a little fun, and catch up on all those if you want to get in on the conversation with us. Feel free to let us know what your favorite adaptations are. Who are your favorite Darcys? Who are your favorite Elizabeths? Who are your favorite Collinses? We want to hear all about all of it. And where can people tell us these things, Jesse?
Yes, you can find us at our website, thedailynightly.com. You can find us on Twitter at nightlypod and Instagram, where Annie is rocking up those memes, The Daily Nightly. And our email address is thedailynightly.com. Or sorry, it says our website. The email is thedailynightly at gmail.com. Check us out. Nightly is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y. And also please rate and review us on whatever platform that you choose. It'll help other people find us and other people send us their awesome, awesome thoughts.
Thank you to Kevin MacLeod for the wonderful music that we use at the beginning and end of the podcast. Till next time, guys.
Happy reading. Or happy watching. Happy
and watching. All of it. Just take in all the Pride and Prejudice, guys. You'll be a better person for it.
Yes, Andy is correct.
Bye.